My son-in-law and I got a little illustration here. It actually ties into the sermon. These people were a tribal group. We didn't go to the Mindanao. You don't go there. It's a dangerous place for foreigners. It's the Blaan tribe. And after this conference, Nancy and I are honorary members of the Blaan tribe. Now, the joke is that they made this jacket for it. Have you ever seen Tommy Boy, the movie? Fat man in a little coat? They had to sew two coats together to get to get one big enough for me. Now, I'm telling you that not just to brag about our cross-cultural experience, but the story today has something to do with cross-cultural ministry. And some of you, did any of you go on the Mexico trip and just got back last night? Great, I'm glad you guys went, glad you got back safe. The backdrop of these verses that Shabes read for us are Jesus' trip, and here it is, in chapters 7. Jesus went up to Tyre, where he met that Syrophoenician woman, up to Sidon. I don't know what he did back there. He came back down through the Decapolis region. This is all Gentile regions, where he some people brought to him a blind man, a deaf man. And then on top of that, Jesus fed the 4,000, the feeding of the 4,000. This all happened in a Gentile region. Now, my personal theory about the guy in Decapolis is that the demoniac had done what Jesus said. He had told his story, and they who heard that story brought this blind guy. Now, the story of the Syrophoenician woman, you've heard about that already, but here's my transition for it. Do you remember what Jesus said to that woman when she begged to have her daughter healed? He said, "I don't give the children's bread to the dogs." That seems like a pretty weird thing for Jesus to say. Well, I think Mark was cluing us into something that transitions into this confrontation with the Pharisees. That line, "don't give God's bread to the dogs," could have been taken from the Pharisees' book of theology. See, the Pharisees were very nationalistic. They felt that God loved the Jews, and he did, and he hated the Gentile dogs. And so when they're confronting Jesus, it's one thing. Jesus did two feeding miracles, one with 5,000 for Jewish people, one for 4,000 with Gentile people. For the Pharisees, that was sacrilegious. You do not give God's food to the Gentile dogs. It's fascinating to me that Jesus spent so much time, and next week when we go on, he's going to be back. At the end of the story, he goes back into Gentile territory. It's fascinating that the leaven of the Pharisees, if you will, is that God had come for the Jews and to punish everyone else. They had completely missed God's real purpose. He announced it to Abraham 4,000 years ago, 2,000 years for them. "I'm going to bless you, Abraham, and your children." And he did. He loved Abraham and his children. For what purpose? To bless all the peoples of the earth. The Blaan people, the Maithili people, the people in Afghanistan, the people in Tarahumara, the people in Mexico, God's intent is to bless all of those peoples with the good news of the gospel. And so when the Pharisees came to Jesus after Jesus returned from this trip, and they say, "give us a sign," you know, they didn't really want a sign. This was a test. It was more than a test. It was a temptation. This word "test" is the same word for what Satan did with Jesus in the wilderness. He tempted him 3 times. The Pharisees are going to do the same with Jesus. tempt him three times. This is the first. The next will be when they question him about divorce in chapter 10. By the way, divorce is what got John the Baptist in trouble, isn't it? He told Herod, you can't be married to your brother's wife. And it ended up costing him his life. The third will be when they try and trick Jesus about paying taxes when they're arguing with him in the temple. See, this is not a request for a sign. How many more signs can Jesus do? He's fed, he's brought bread from heaven, just like Moses did in Exodus. He's raised a girl from the dead. How many signs can he give? He has given plenty of signs. They're looking just, you remember the story in Mark 3:6, when this man with the withered hand was in church on the Sabbath, and the Pharisees were watching to see if Jesus was going to heal or work on the Sabbath. And he did. He healed that man's hand. And from that point on, all the way to the crucifixion, the Pharisees are scheming and plotting and conspiring to murder Jesus. And part of it was this all people's emphasis of Jesus. They didn't want a sign. They wanted to disrupt and hurt. Now, it's not so shocking for us to see the hardness of the Pharisees. Mark's been developing that theme for a long time. Herod's hardness of heart is really not so shocking either. We know Herod, when you look at the party that Herod threw and contrast that with the party Jesus threw, feeding 5,000 calmly on the ground, Herod's party was a bad party. We're not surprised that those kind of characters had hard hearts, which I would say is one way to describe the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees. There's a hardness towards God there. But when you see the hardness of heart in the disciples, that's a little distressing. Their hearts had also become hardened. And that happened in the feeding of the 5,000. I'm just going to review that just a little bit. At the end of that story, in the feeding of the 5,000, you remember that Jesus, the crowds came. Jesus said, I have compassion. The disciples said, send them away. Jesus said, you feed them. He had asked them to do something that was impossible for them. It was impossible. I think they got mad about that, because by the end of the story, they asked Jesus to send the crowds away. Well, what happened is Jesus sent them away, got them in the boat, told them to leave, and that evening he walked on the water past the boat. They were having a hard time rowing. What did they think he was? They thought he was a ghost. And the last part of that line, I think it's 6:52, it said, because they had not understood about the loaves and their hearts were hardened. From that story until this story, the disciples have fallen into a hardness of heart. And I think, I'd be interested to hear what some of you think about this. I'm trying to, I revised this sermon, I think, 6 times. The last time this morning at 6. Grappling with what was it about the loaves that they did not understand. And here's my thought. See, Jesus had asked them to do something that was impossible and that they couldn't do. He's going to ask them to do something else impossible in a few weeks. He's going to ask them to take the gospel from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria to the ends of the earth. That too was impossible. Has the Lord ever asked you to do something impossible? If we follow him, he will ask us to do something impossible. What do you do when the Lord asks you to do the impossible? You go to him. He can do the impossible. We can't. And I think that was the lesson of the loaves, that when you are asked by the Lord to do the impossible, don't get angry, don't get sarcastic, don't run the other direction. go to the guy who can do it. He can do it. But in their case, their hearts had become hardened. And when you read this next passage, when Jesus begins to ask them a series of questions, you can almost hear the frustration in his voice. I have to read these the list here. He talks about the leaven of the Pharisees, and he tells them a parable about bread and yeast and influence. And their response is, oh man, we got nothing for lunch. Now see, this is blindness. They're in the boat with the guy who can create food just like Moses did in Exodus. And they're worried about lunch. We forgot to bring bread. Their hearts were hardened. They were spiritually blinded. This series of questions from Jesus is, why are you talking about bread? Do you not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? Do you not remember? Do you not understand? Now, this is a prelude to Jesus helping them see again. But this series of questions, it's unusual in Mark to have this long series of questions. What's Jesus going to do? You know, in just a few weeks, Jesus is going to be delivered, suffer, be crucified, and died. And these 12 guys and their buddies are supposed to be the ones to carry the gospel on. And they're worried about lunch instead of thinking about the bread from heaven. Now, I think there's another strange story. Talking to the woman about being a dog, that doesn't really seem to, it stands out. Now, here's a story, the next one, where Jesus touches the blind person twice. What's going on? Why does it take him two touches? I mean, if he can call down bread from heaven, if he can raise the dead, he should be able to heal a blind person the first time. Again, I think Mark's cluing us into something that's going to happen in the next few verses with Peter and is going to continue happening with the disciples over and over. Jesus does have the power to restore sight to those who cannot see. He is able to soften the hearts of those who have become hardened by their rejection or whatever it was they missed about those loaves. But it doesn't necessarily happen all at once. He touches this blind guy twice. And I think it's a true story. I have no question that it's a true healing, and he really did it twice. And this thing about in those days, saliva was considered to have medicinal properties. So this story sounds really weird to us, but it wouldn't have been strange to them. Doctors did this in that day. But he touched him twice. Well, I think Jesus is going to touch the disciples twice and three times and four times, on and on and on. And that happens in this next story. This is a lot to cover, so I'm moving really quick. You could spend several weeks just in these sections. And also, this is a summary and an introduction passage. It's summarizing Simon's confession, "You are the Christ." That's like the hinge point of the book of Mark. It's the turning point. And the flavor of Mark's story and the feel of it changes dramatically from chapter 8 to the end of the book, as Jesus explains and demonstrates who the Christ really is. But the series of questions that Jesus asked, "Why are you talking about bread? Don't you get it?" is part of the first touch for the disciples. He's asking them questions, asking them to reflect on what they've heard, the condition of their heart. And then again, and I'll show you a map next week, he goes back into Gentile territory and takes them on another short-term missionary trip way to the north end of Israel, to where Philip, Herodias' first husband, had his summer palace. Nancy and I have actually been there. It's a beautiful area. It's the beginning of the Jordan River. It's cool and it's calm. You can see why Philip and other rich people built their summer cabins up in Caesarea Philippi. And again, you might ask the question, as Jesus was revealing who he was, why is he doing it up in the middle of nowhere in a pagan area instead of going to Jerusalem? I'll leave that one alone for later. But again, I think it has to do with his purpose for all peoples. I think it has to do with that. The disciples are with him in the boat, and he says, who do people say I am? And the answers are what we heard from Philip, John the Baptist, raised from the dead, a reincarnation of Elijah, or maybe some other prophet, which is interesting in itself. Everyone seemed to know Jesus was something unusual. No one just said, oh, he's a good teacher. They knew something unusual about him. And then he asks yet another question. And this is the question. It is the question for all people of all time, from all languages and all tongues. It's the question for us. Who do you say I am? Who do you say that I am? It's interesting that he uses, you remember that when Moses asked God, what's your name? And God said, my name is I am. And Jesus is coming back to that same question. He's telling him, who do you say I am? And through this series of questions and the first touch and the second touch, Peter gets it right. You are the Christ. Well, he gets the part right. Next week we'll go into Jesus explaining what the Christ means, and that's not what Peter meant when he said, you are the Christ. This is a fascinating story to me. And I've studied missions. I'm a missiologist, so I brought missions into this, but I think it's actually in the text, and some of the Kernahan talks about this. Okay. I could go on and on and on. I did prune this down, Will, from the original outline. Some reflection for us. How's our hearts doing? Now, I got to tell you how proud I am of the Firm Family Fellowship and the way the Lord has moved us into multiple cross-cultural. We just got, how many people went to Mexico? 60 people went to Mexico to serve. We're involved in Afghanistan through summer. We're doing things. John was in with the Tarahumara in northeast Mexico. For a small fellowship, we have been and are being blessed with our engagement cross-culturally. And brothers and sisters, let's go for it. Let's keep going for it. It's an amazing thing. At least in that, we're understanding God's heart for the world and participating. Keep going, keep giving, keep praying. It's more difficult for me to cross borders in my own town and in my own circles than it is overseas. It's a little freer overseas. So it's worth reflecting on the boundaries that we've set, maybe not cultural boundaries, maybe social, maybe ethnic, maybe status. Is the Lord moving us into crossing some of those boundaries? He crossed them. Maybe it's something we need to reflect on. Questions. How do we deal with questions? See, I think the Lord invites us to listen to our questions, to his questions, and to live with questions as part of his illuminating or enlightening process. See, the Pharisees didn't ask any questions. They had God all figured out. They had him surrounded in their nice little box. They knew just who he was, they thought. They knew just how he behaved, they thought. They knew just how they should behave, they thought. Brothers and sisters, part of spiritual maturity, as I understand it, is there becomes more and more and more of us, and fewer and fewer and fewer of them. If you find yourself happy in your box and not listening to questions from the Lord, beware. Just as Jesus told the disciples, beware. We don't want to be like those guys who had every reason to know who God was, but did not know who he was. They had written him out of their understanding of God and his purposes. Last thought, two more thoughts. Expect multiple touches over your lifetime. See, we really don't know it all yet. None of us do. And the Lord will use those questions, circumstances, pressures, often it's doubts or difficult things that the Lord uses to touch us and get us to look differently at ourselves and at our world. We don't find him. We don't enlighten ourselves. It's his touch that does that. And so let's be waiting for and watching for his touch. Last application, and this one I do mean a lot. Next Friday afternoon and Saturday, church staff and elders are meeting for our annual evaluation and planning meeting. Please pray that we would have eyes to see and ears to hear. We all got we got six of us and we have 47 opinions. If you've been on boards, that's how they work. But we really do want to hear from the Lord and cooperate with him. So I appreciate your praying for us. Let me close us in prayer. Thank you, Lord, that you are the one that reveals. You touch us personally. You soften our hearts. Do that for us, please, this week and this year. Amen.